go ahead and just keep your place there in Nehemiah. That's where I'm going to be spending the majority of our time this evening. My attempt is going to be to cover the first four chapters of Nehemiah. Whether that's daring or not, we'll see. But I wanted to do the whole story of Nehemiah, but I wasn't quite sure that I'd have enough time to do it all justice. So here in the first chapter of Nehemiah, we have Nehemiah, who is, later we'll find out, the cupbearer to King Artaxerxes. The story is told from the first person, from Nehemiah's point of view. This is, I'll tell you, this is something that kind of drew me to the story. I enjoy first-person narrative. We're in the month of Kislev, which in our calendar would be November, December, the beginning of winter for someone in that part of the world. And Nehemiah finds himself in captivity in the city of Shushan, or Susa, which is about 200 miles east of Babylon, and it's the winter home of the kings of Babylon. It's kind of their, I guess it would be the opposite of Lake Tahoe. I think Lake Tahoe is a summer home, but it's Florida for the snowbirds, I guess. And here in the first chapter, we have Nehemiah. He hears from Hanani and some men that have come back with him that the Jews who are still in Jerusalem are in pretty bad shape. The city has no fortification. It still lies in ruin, left as it was after the conquest. The gates are burned, and Nehemiah finds this very distressful. He immediately starts mourning. And we'll find some insight as we go later on to hear the prayer that he prays to God, that perhaps this isn't just because his mourning isn't just because of the state of Jerusalem. I'm sure probably had some fond memories of Jerusalem as a younger person. I'm not really sure if he was born in captivity or not, but at least he had heard stories of Jerusalem in its heyday, so to say. And so here in his prayer, he says, "Remember, I pray, the word that you commanded your servant Moses, saying, if you are unfaithful, I will scatter you among the nations. But if you return to me and keep my commandments and do them, though some of you were cast out to the farthest part of the heavens, yet I will gather you from there and bring them to the place which I have chosen as a dwelling for my name." And this is, you'll find this passage in Deuteronomy chapter 30, verses 2 through 5. And if you go back and get some time, look at Deuteronomy 29 and 30, and that covenant that God makes there with Moses and the Jewish people basically sets up the next 1,500 years of Jewish history. They're falling away from God and being taken captive or falling into distress such as this, and then they're God restoring them. This is the covenant that sets that up. And let's go ahead and go on to chapter 2, and I'll just go ahead and read the first couple of verses of that. "And it came to pass in the month of Nisan, in the 20th year of King Artaxerxes, when wine was before him, that I took the wine and gave it to the king. Now I had never been sad in his presence before." So here we have Nehemiah, who is a slave, but he's a slave of fairly high position to the king. Someone who would have been a cupbearer to the king would have had close daily interaction. He would have had to know what was acceptable behavior before royalty. And he would have conducted himself well. You can look at some other characters in the Old Testament, Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and Joseph were all in positions that were similar to this, where they, because of their good conduct and God's providence, they were in positions where they were able to do great things, and they were good enough men that they took advantage of that. And so think about a slave, someone who was doing their job by force, even though he probably had one of the easier jobs, being cheerful at work every single day. You know, he'd never been before the king, and the king had never seen him downcast or anything like that. I actually read in a commentary that it said perhaps because he was the cupbearer, he had to taste the wine before the king, and that's why he was glad every day. Kind of got a little pep before he went before the king. But I don't think that's the case. I think that he actually was just an upright person and sounds like a pretty pleasant young man to have around, and able to be of good service. So, let me read on here. So, therefore the king said to me, "Why is your face sad, since you are not sick? This is nothing but sorrow of heart." So I became dreadfully afraid, and said to the king, "May the king live forever. Why should my face not be sad, when the city, the place of my father's tombs, lies waste, and its gates are burned with fire?" And so, here I think Nehemiah probably, one thing I meant to talk about, the month of Nisan is a couple months after the month of Chislev, when Nehemiah first hears word of how things are going in Jerusalem. So I think Nehemiah has taken this time after he prays this prayer to God that he'll be able to go before the king and find mercy for the children of Israel. I think he takes this time to maybe study the king a little bit, try to maybe determine what way to best do that. And in verse 3, Nehemiah places emphasis on not necessarily on the plight of the people, but the emphasis that he places is on his forefathers' tombs. This is the land that my ancestors are from, and it's been laid to waste. He doesn't really make a lot of mention of the plight of the people that are there. And I think maybe that's an appeal to Artaxerxes, just his position, being a king, being named after his father. Perhaps this is something that Nehemiah thought Artaxerxes would maybe kind of pull at the heartstrings of Artaxerxes a little bit and cause him to maybe soften a little bit. I think you can also take the emphasis that he places on the forefathers' tombs, and if you look back in Genesis 49 and 50, where it talks about how Jacob and Joseph both made sure that the people that survived them knew that they wanted to be buried in the Promised Land. That this was something that that was very important to them, and it was their heritage from God. It was promised to them, and it had a great deal of significance to the Jewish people. And we read more about that in Hebrews 11:22, when we have it's commonly called the roll call of faith, and it talks about how Joseph gave instructions concerning his bones. I'm going to catch up with myself here. So here we have, let me go on and read verse 4. Then the king said to me, "What do you request?" So I prayed to the God of heaven. So here we have Nehemiah. He prays to God again. And he's gone to God the first time, and he's prayed this prayer, and he said, you know, let King Artaxerxes, have mercy on me, and so he'll allow me to do this. And here he prays to God again. And he goes ahead and he asks the king. And I said to the king, if it pleases the king, and if your servant has found favor in your sight, I ask that you send me to Judah, to the city of my father's tombs, that I may rebuild it. So here he talks about his father's tombs again. Verse 6, then the king said to me, the queen also sitting behind him, how long will your journey be, and when will you return? So it pleased the king to send me, and I set him a time. So I think here we see maybe another reason why it took Nehemiah so long after hearing from the men that came back from Judah to the day that he actually talked about the king is he just immediately, right like that, he has a plan. He's probably been devising this plan. It wasn't something like, you know, he's just trying to get up the guts to ask him, and then when he asks him, the king says, okay, and he doesn't have any plan. Here Nehemiah immediately has a plan, and he's able to provide a schedule for the journey and a schedule for building a wall. And we talked about this a little bit last night when we were talking about mortgages at the financial meeting and counting the cost. Nehemiah has he's considered the cost of this trip. That's in Romans 13. He's considered the cost of this trip before he even presents it. So he's able to present it as a wiser plan to the king. And let me go on and read some more here. Furthermore, I said to the king, if it pleases the king, let letters be given to me for the governors of the region beyond the river, that they must permit me to pass through till I come to Judah, and a letter to Asaph, the keeper of the king's forest, that he must give me timber to make beams for the gates of the citadel, which pertains to the temple, for the city wall, and for the house that I will occupy. And the king granted them to me according to the good hand of my God upon me. So here we have even more planning that that Nehemiah has made. Region beyond the river. The river refers to the Euphrates. That was on the other side of the Euphrates was Babylon, and Shushan was on the eastern side of that river as well. And I think that was, you know, maybe or Mason-Dixon line or whatever that was their delineation between maybe this is Babylon and the rest is beyond the river. And the king's forest, I found pretty good indications that would have been in Lebanon. Lebanon's famous for its cedars. I don't know how useful cedars would be. I've never been to Lebanon. I don't know how big the cedars grow there, but in my mind, I have a smaller tree, maybe more suitable for ornate kind of finished carpentry, but I read about Lebanon a little bit, and there's also some big, strong oaks and pine trees that would be suitable for structures and perhaps some scaffolding, just things of that sort. And so this is just more of Nehemiah setting up plans ahead of time. I don't know if maybe he heard a little bit. If he asked for these letters when Ezra, in the book before this, about 13 years before Nehemiah makes his trip, Ezra was given one letter. And he got a letter from King Artaxerxes. And the idea that I get is basically whenever they met with someone, then Ezra or someone in the group would present this letter and say, we're here on official business of the king, and they were able to pass through. And I don't know if maybe Artaxerxes learned a lesson from that, or if if Nehemiah learned a lesson or exactly how that worked, but there were multiple letters that were sent out, and because Ezra had a little bit of problems, they were fearful in their journey. They were afraid of ambush. I think it's important to note that this is one of the key phrases in Nehemiah that we find. It's the good hand of my God upon me. So Nehemiah is sure to say that the king granted me these things because of God's hand. He's willing to attribute this to God, and he recognizes that his prayers have been answered, and that he's set out to do this good work with God's blessing. Another thing that Ezra didn't get on his trip back to Jerusalem was a military escort. And here we see that King Artaxerxes sends a military escort with Nehemiah. I'll go ahead and read on. When Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite official heard of it, they were deeply disturbed that a man had come to seek the well-being of the children of Israel. You have these two characters, I'll call them characters just because that's what they are. Sanballat the Horonite, he was from a city in Moab, which is would be on the east side of the river, of the Jordan River. And Tobiah, who was from Ammon, Tobiah is actually described as a servant of Ammon. And I don't know if that meant that he was necessarily a slave, but he was their designated representative. I think this was one of the representatives that received the letter about Nehemiah's trip through here. And so they just can't believe that someone would want to come and help the children of Israel. Start in verse 11 here. So I came to Jerusalem and was there 3 days. Then I arose in the night, I and a few men with me. I told no one what my God had put in my heart to do in Jerusalem, nor was there any animal with me except the one on which I rode. And I went out by night through the valley gate to the serpent well and the refuse gate, and viewed the walls of Jerusalem, which were broken down, and its gates, which were burned with fire. Then I went on to the fountain gate and to the king's pool, but there was no room for the animal under me to pass. So I went up in the night by the valley and viewed the wall. Then I turned back and entered by the valley gate, and so returned. Here Nehemiah, he's arrived in Jerusalem, and if you go later on in I believe it's chapter 6, you can kind of count backwards and figure out that it took him about 3 or 4 months to get there. He was able to travel a little bit more quickly than Ezra was, because Ezra had a large group. They were constantly in fear of ambush, and he had a lot of women and children, which meant a lot of stops. Nehemiah was able to travel so much more quickly because he had a smaller group. It's probably likely that they traveled during the night, because when they traveled was the hottest part of the year, and they're traveling right across the middle of a desert in order to get there. And so starting in verse 11, or actually 12, we have where Nehemiah gets up in the middle of the night. I don't know if this is because he was trying to be secretive still, or if it was just so oppressively hot that nobody could stand to be out doing things during the day. But he goes and he heads south out the Valley Gate, and which is on the very south end of Jerusalem. and he travels east, basically. If you're looking at it top down, you can turn. It's a fairly detailed map in the back of your Bible, probably. He goes counterclockwise up the Kidron Valley to basically about to the spot where the temple is, and turns around and comes back. And this just from 12 to 15 describes what he sees, that the city truly is in ruins. You know, nobody was telling him the story. And all the gates are burned, the walls are broken down, and there's just piles of rubble everywhere. And it also says that in verse 16, and the officials did not know where I had gone or what I had done. I had not yet told the Jews, the priests, the nobles, the officials, or the others who did the work. And so here we have, he goes out at night, and nobody knows why he's there. This is another indication to me that he had a fairly small party with him. If he would have had a large party, he probably would have had to explain to a lot of people that we're not just taking a trip, we're going back to rebuild Jerusalem, and probably that would have gotten out. But with a smaller group, I think he's able to keep it a little bit more of a secret. And I think in verse 17, I'm going to make a transition in what my purpose is, and I think after verse 17, then we can start thinking and thinking about things a little bit more in terms of the church. So let me pick up in verse 17. "But I said to them, you see the distress that we are in, how Jerusalem lies waste, and its gates are burned with fire. Come and let us build the wall of Jerusalem, that we may no longer be a reproach. And I told them of the hand of my God, which had been good upon me, and also of the king's words that he had spoken to me. So they said, let us rise up and build. Then they set their hands to this good work." He highlights God's blessing that has been on him. He highlights that he has the king's blessing, and he says that this is they're going to rebuild the city of Jerusalem so that there'll no longer be a reproach. One verse that this made me think of, if you'll turn over to Psalms 127. "Unless the Lord builds the house, they labor in vain who build it. Unless the Lord guards the city, the watchman stays awake in vain." And so here you have that Nehemiah takes them and lets them know that he has God's blessing, which is, as we see from Psalms 127, that's the most important part of it. And so the people see that this is a good thing, and they're ready to start work. And so here in verse 19, let me take a step back here. Also in Hebrews 10:24, says, "Let us consider one another in order to stir up love and good works." So here, Nehemiah, he's kind of rallied the people and he's stirring them up to this good work, as it says in verse 18. So we'll go back to verse 19. "But when Sanballat the Horonite, Tobiah the Ammonite official, and Geshem the Arab heard of it, they laughed at us and despised us and said, 'What is this thing that you are doing? Will you rebel against the king?' So I answered them and said to them, 'The God of heaven himself will prosper us. Therefore, we as servants will arise and build, but you have no heritage or right or memorial in Jerusalem.'" So we pick up another friend of Sanballat and Tobiah. He's Geshem the Arab. Would have been just another one of Jerusalem's neighbors across the Jordan River. And I think it's interesting that they ask him if he's going to rebel against the king. I don't know necessarily why they would ask that. I think they make accusations later on in the book that Nehemiah is trying to set himself up as a governor, as an independent king of Jerusalem, and so that may be what they're driving at. But Nehemiah is not even concerned with that. Instead of taking his letter and, you know, saying, we've got the king's blessing, he says it doesn't matter because they have the blessing of God. And I think that's one comparison that you can make to the church, that, you know, we answer to one authority, and that's it. We're not part of a separate organization. We're not established by the government. We've been studying Revelations a little bit on Thursday nights with Kyle and Stephanie, and there are so many. If you look back through the history of the church, you see that there are so many different governing bodies, governments, world powers that have tried to control people through the church, and with the true church, that's not to be the case. And so Nehemiah points out that they're going to succeed because they have God's blessing, and he also points out to them that they don't have any heritage in Jerusalem. It's not their inheritance like it is the children of Israel's. And so they're taking it back. They're claiming it for their own by doing God's will. It is basically how that goes. And that brings us to chapter 3. In chapter 3, we have the account of basically who builds the wall. It reads kind of like a list of subcontractors that you would have when you have a large construction job. The general contractor will have what they call a sublist that has a list of everyone, all of the subcontractors who are working on a job. And there's your construction trivia. This seems really similar to that because it has an account of everyone who's working on every place in the wall. And it's really extensive. And I can just kind of imagine Nehemiah standing there, and he's got this group of the children of Israel in front of him, and he says, okay, you guys over there, you guys, and write to make sure that the entire wall is covered, that every single part of the wall is being covered. You'll find all kinds of, if you read through here, there's different trades in there. There's some perfumers and some goldsmiths, which were likely brought back to work on the temple with Ezra. Verse 5, it's interesting to note that he has some nobles from a certain group that wouldn't put their shoulders to the work of their Lord. And it's kind of like Nehemiah calls them out for that a little bit, and so they don't get any credit that they're not due, maybe. Maybe some comparisons that we can make to the church in chapter 3 is the people were doing God's work. Let's go to Colossians chapter 1. Pages are always stickier up here. Starting verse 9. For this reason we also, since the day we heard it, do not cease to pray for you and to ask that you may be filled with the knowledge of His will and all wisdom and spiritual understanding, that you may walk worthy of the Lord, fully pleasing Him, being fruitful in every good work and increasing in the knowledge of God, strengthened with all might according to His glorious power, for all patience and long-suffering with joy, giving thanks to the Father who is qualified to be partakers of the inheritance of the saints in the light. He has delivered us from the power of darkness and conveyed us into the kingdom of the Son of His love. Make sure I don't read too long. In whom we have redemption through His blood, the forgiveness of sins. He is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn over all creation. For by Him all things were created, that are in heaven, that are on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or principalities or powers. All things were created through him and for him. And he is before all things, and in him all things consist. And he is the head of the body, the church, who is the beginning, the firstborn from the dead, that in all things he may have the preeminence. And also, all of the people could do something. There weren't. There's one group that had a man's daughters in it. The work wasn't exclusive to any specific trade it didn't exclude the women. There was something that the women could do also, and I think if you compare this to Titus 2, where we talked about Titus 1 a little bit this morning, but in Titus 2 we have kind of some of the roles and the jobs that different people in the church can do according to their specific demographic, I guess. And so there's something that everyone could do. And then, as I mentioned before, there was work on all sides. The wall of Jerusalem is being rebuilt completely around there. And I think you can compare this to the whole body of Christ in 1 Corinthians. Chapter 12, verse 12. For as the body is one and has many members, but all the members of that one body, being many, are one body, so also is Christ. For by one Spirit we were all baptized into one body, whether Jews or Greeks, whether slaves or free, and have all been made to drink into one Spirit. For in fact, the body is not one member, but many. If the foot should say, because I am not a hand, I am not of the body, is it therefore not of the body? And if the ear should say, because I am not an eye, I am not of the body, is it therefore not of the body? If the whole body were an eye, where would be the hearing? If the whole were hearing, where would be the smelling? But now God has set the members, each one of them, in the body just as he pleased. And if they were all one member, where would the body be? But now indeed there are many members, yet one body. So here we have, if you compare the completeness of Christ's body to the completeness of the wall being built around Jerusalem, that each one has been lined out to their different part of the wall to work, and they're set to do that specifically. Let's go ahead and move on to chapter 4. The first couple verses kind of check back in with their friends across the river, and they're Sanballat and Tobiah and are mocking them and saying, you know, are they going to get this? Are they just going to do this in a day? You know, they're so gung-ho, they're just, you know, they're not going to be able to do it, is basically what they're saying. And Tobias says, if a fox goes up on it, this wall is so shaky that it'll fall right down because of the weight of the fox. And if we turn to Psalm 118, verse 6, the Lord is on my side, I will not fear. What can man do to me? This is kind of the stance that they take, that they really don't need to be concerned with what's going on with their enemies across the river, and they're just able to be about their work and get it done. And when Nehemiah hears about this, he kind of says, it's almost like he asks God, he says, I know you're not going to let this go unpunished, you know. He says, you know, consider it, just kind of almost like he pronounces a curse on him, but he doesn't quite. and because they're provoking God. And in verse 6, it brings out that the people had a mind to work. And I think this is what you see when they first get started up. You know, they're really fervent about this, and they're able to get started right away and really go to town on it. And I think that's maybe part of what the mocking was about, was they perhaps they thought that maybe it wasn't going to, that they were going to burn out fairly quickly. I think if we look down through the rest of chapter 4 quickly, you'll see that they're continually praying to God, which the parallel there is obvious. We're supposed to pray without ceasing, and that was this specific endeavor and the difficulty that they were experiencing. They were praying continually. They set a watch. Their enemies start to come against them, and they set a watch to watch for the enemy so that they'll know when they're going to come. In 1 Corinthians 16:13, Paul tells us to watch and stand fast. And then later on in the chapter, it comes to the point where they're actually going to have to defend themselves. And here we have turned to Jude, the first chapter of Jude. The only chapter of Jude. Beloved, while I was diligent... Sorry. Verse 3. Beloved, while I was very diligent to write to you concerning our common salvation, I found it necessary to write to you, exhorting you to contend earnestly for the faith which was once for all delivered to the saints. So here we have this, I think part of what this contending is that Jude is writing about here is maybe defense, kind of a little bit of defending the faith. Let's see. Nehemiah reminds them in verse 14, he says, "Do not be afraid of them. Remember the Lord, and great and awesome, and fight for your brethren, your sons, your daughters, your wives, and your houses." And I think this is just their theme all through the book, is that Nehemiah is constantly remembering God, remembering how good God has been to him, and acknowledging that. And then something that I thought was interesting that he added on to that, that when you are fighting, consider your family and your countrymen that you're fighting with here. And that's very, very similar to the church today. We have to consider that when we do something or when we are acting or exhorting or anything, we have to consider that we're interdependent on each other. We're dependent on each other for correction and things like that, but also to make sure that we hold to the truth. And I think that's something that we can draw out of that. And there's just some other ideas that are brought out here, that they're having to build and defend at the same time. I think that's very similar to the church. We're constantly building. If we stop building, then we stop being. And similar to that, we're always having to discern and defend what we believe. And their constant vigilance of having to keep guard day and night. And then it also says in verse 22, "Let each man and his servant stay at night in Jerusalem, that they may be our guard by day and a working part, be our guard by night and a working party by day." You have this idea that there's safety within the walls of Jerusalem, just like there's safety. That was a big part of what we talked about this morning. There's safety within the fold of the church. And we're able to protect each other and guard each other and keep watch for each other. That's all that I had as far as Nehemiah goes. One thing, just as I was studying, I came close to Isaiah chapter 52, and just things that I underline every once in a while. I was in 51 looking, and I happened to see over in chapter 52 this that had been underlined in my Bible, just something that struck me at one time. It's verse 3. For thus says the Lord, you have sold yourselves for nothing, and you shall be redeemed without money. If you find yourself away from God, outside the fold of the church, and outside of Christ's blood, then you sold yourself for nothing. I mean, the lifestyle that you're maintaining is going to bring you no benefit in eternity. The things that are keeping you from Christ are going to bring you no gain. And you shall be redeemed without money. That I think demonstrates the pricelessness of Christ's sacrifice. It wasn't something that could be purchased with money. It wasn't anything that anyone but Christ could have done for us. And it's a necessity. Anyone who maintains that lifestyle is going to gain you anything is incorrect. And the only way to have happiness in at least the next life, but probably this life also, is through Christ. So if you find yourself needful of that, please come forward as we stand and sing.